Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, February 15th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Good morning, Ethan.
How are we doing, Steve?
And joining us later will be Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror will check in with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Ethan, let's start with sharks. Last September saw the Cape's first fatal shark attack. Now there's growing concern that as we're moving toward another summer season, towns and management officials haven't been maybe proactive enough in addressing this new threat, not only to beachgoers, but to the region's economy.
Yeah, I mean, the shark attack kind of really, I think, changed the psyche for a lot of people. They're all still trying to figure out how do we handle this? What do we do as, I mean, it is, what, February now, but, I mean, we're on our way to summer, so they're still trying to figure everything out. There's been forums, there's been classes, they're still really trying to figure things out. A lot of people are criticizing there isn't enough concrete stuff being done. Mm-hmm. There's kind of studies enacted. One of the things is there's trying to get a meeting between state, federal, and different officials. One of the problems is the National Seashore, which is federal government. The government shutdown has kind of affected their workings. So yeah, it's been an interesting few months. Doug Fraser did this story, and one of the things was complaints. I think it was a surfer. There was a recent surfer meeting, but
there's a public forum that the surfers hosted.
Yeah.
Taking on the issue of how we're going to address the sharks going forward.
And one of the things that was pointed out was there's no one's job is to tackle this, which I think kind of,
right.
That's one of the things is you have all these different agencies and everyone's trying to figure out whose job it is to do this. In Australia,
different agencies, different towns up and down the coast, and everybody's kind of looking at it, but nobody's the one that sits over top of everything and decides what the plan should be.
Yeah, no one goes to work on Monday morning and says, my job is to take care of sharks. I mean, maybe Greg Skolmel, but it's not his job to figure everything out here. But there are places, New South Wales and Australia, they have a state agency that has to deal with shark management. California has something else similar to that. It's really something that everyone's still kind of worried about.
And there is one study that has been proposed that's kind of being put together now by a group called the Woods Hole Group. Mm-hmm. And it's bringing together a number of different parties with towns up and down the Outer Cape there and also the National Seashore. But I guess people are concerned that it's been slow to get going.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever seen a government study, those don't get done in 2 or 3 months. And that's the worry is study could take years, possibly, and we still have to deal with the shark issue this summer. There's no real Cape tourism if you don't know water. And like you said, sharks don't worry about town lines or where all this stuff is. So, yeah, it should be an interesting thing as we come to Memorial Day. A lot of people are worried even about sharks showing up in areas they've never really seen them. There's Oyster Pond over in Chatham, which is where they have the swimming stuff, the swimming lessons for kids. So it's something that a lot of people are worried about and still trying to figure out how to handle.
Now, this Woods Hole Group study that we've been talking about, this is supposed to look at technological solutions, perhaps, towards addressing the shark problem, which could mean, I guess, you know, drones or even some kind of netting, as they're looking at in Oyster Pond, perhaps, to protect that.
Yeah, and there's sonar. I think one of the big things that people are talking about now to try and tackle is the phones, trying to get service out in some of these areas. Because if you've ever been to some of these Outer Cape beaches and Truro and Wellfleet, I mean, you're not getting any service. I mean, you have to run up to the parking lot, and even then sometimes you're out on the road hoping to try and get service. So I think that's been one of the big things is trying to make the response better. But a lot of people, like you said, they want a little more proactive ways on how to get these
That's true. One of the concerns here, voice that Greg, or rather that Doug Fraser points to in this article, is that the concern that there's been a lot of attention on response. What happens when there's a shark bite? Can we improve communications? Can we get people off the beach quicker? But what about management? How are we managing the shark threat overall, and how do you try to address it? And that's where people are wondering whether we don't need some kind of overarching agency to take this on the Cape, like they have, as you said, in Australia or somewhere like that, where they have an agency. And even California, Doug Fraser points out in this piece, has kind of the lifeguard agency, it sounds like, has much more, is empowered much more to set rules and do management around sharks. And nobody here on the Cape is yet empowered to look at management questions around the shark issues.
Yeah, it's definitely a jurisdiction kind of issue, and which it doesn't seem to fall in anyone's lap.
And the state, they've been looking for money from the state for this, but the state has not yet come up with money, in part because there's no study yet that the state can attach the money to.
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg kind of situation at the moment.
Let's move on. There was a big turnout Wednesday evening to a meeting about the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office working with ICE, which is the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement. There are strong feelings on both sides about whether this collaboration should even be happening.
Yeah, I mean, ICE obviously has been a very controversial just organization in general. I mean, you have people saying abolish ICE. And at this meeting, there was people wearing I Heart ICE necklaces around and saying build the wall and stuff like that. This was a meeting. It's something that's required through the partnership between the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office and ICE. So annually they have to hold a meeting to say, this is kind of what we do. It was an informational meeting. There was no votes. There was no real kind of just letting people know kind of how it works. And I mean, so the program authorizes county sheriff officers to, they're kind of deputized. So they're allowed to now enforce portions of immigration law, which is a federal law. So normally Barnstable County sheriffs wouldn't be allowed to handle that.
Mm-hmm. And this was a Wednesday in Buzzards Bay, and a big turnout for this meeting.
Yeah, I think, how much did we say? It was maybe 200 people packed in the Bourne's Veteran Community Center, which I don't know if you've ever been there. It's not a massive building. There's a gym there, but yeah, that's where all the selectmen meetings are held, and they're much more sparsely attended, I'll tell you that.
and people came from across the Cape. There was turnout there from the outer Cape driving a good distance to participate here and to raise some questions. What kinds of questions were people asking here?
A lot of it was kind of, how does it work? There was also kind of the moral question of should immigration law in general kind of be enforced. A lot of people also expressed their support, saying they feel safer. They're glad that they're doing this. Last year, I think 79 inmates were referred to ICE from the county correctional facility over there in Buzzards Bay. And that was their first full year in the program. In the grand scheme, that's not a whole lot. I think the last 6 months, they said, of the inmates, that was only 0.06%. So you're not talking a ton of people, but a lot of people is just kind of the core idea of this immigration law, that some of them took umbrage with that.
And I guess there are concerns about due process. What happens is people get sucked into the system, that they're arrested on one charge and then they're sort of turned over, if they might have outstanding immigration violations, turned over to the federal authorities. And who's following these people along and making sure that due process is being served?
Yeah, so if you get convicted and you're an undocumented immigrant, what happens is you have to serve your sentence first before you are handed over to ICE. It's basically, this program really opens up the communication lines between ICE and the county correctional facility, which could be changing soon. I know there was a bill filed in Beacon Hill recently. I think it was actually refiled. It didn't get through last time. But basically what it would do is end this partnership and not allow local law enforcement agencies work with the federal ICE program.
And it's worth pointing out that in New England, there's only three counties that are participating in this program in all of New England. And they're Barnstable County, Bristol County, and Plymouth County.
Yeah, us two neighbors, so the entire southeast, lower southeast, and then Bristol County. I mean, and Plymouth County is a very large county, too. So, I mean, two big swaths.
Yeah. We're going to speak now with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Noah, the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind is proceeding through a series of public hearings around the region intended to let people weigh in on its plans for their utility-scale wind farm proposed for south of Martha's Vineyard. You're covering this from an island perspective. Tell us what you can tell us about what's happening here from the island view.
Yeah, so this is a really big project. The project itself is going to include 84 turbines and it's going to be 800 megawatts of energy, which is a lot of energy. But it's going to be located about 14 miles south of Waiskwe Point in Edgartown. So really the closest thing to the project is going to be Martha's Vineyard. The Martha's Vineyard Commission, though, has jurisdiction over only a small portion of the project, and that's going to be these two undersea transport cables that will transmit the electricity that's generated by the turbines to an onshore switching station in Barnstable. So the cables themselves are about 40 to 50 miles long, and they run, but they're going to run north right by the eastern part of Chappaquiddick, and they're going to be about a mile from shore. So that's what the Martha's Vineyard Commission is going to be looking at next week.
What are the concerns that folks have about these cables and how they might impact the island?
Well, as you can imagine, a project that's this wide-ranging does have its share of environmental concerns. The cables themselves are going to be inserted into the seafloor with something called a jet plow, and the jet shoots water and then moves sand out of the way to create these trenches, and then the cables are inserted from a barge above water into the trenches and buried about 5 to 8 feet beneath the seafloor. So, like, if you think about that, that means that it's going to be interrupting benthic habitat, and there's going to be this big barge in the water where vineyard fishermen are generally, you know, that's where a lot of their fish are. And also, there's concern about large marine mammals. The part of the project that is going to be traveling, or the part of the cable route is going to go right through where the North Atlantic right whale's habitat is. And Vineyard Wind actually has, they've just worked with conservation groups to agree that if any right whales are spotted in the area, they are going to stop, they're going to cease construction immediately, and then they're only going to proceed at the speed of one knot, and construction crews are going to dampen their sound. So it looks like Vineyard Wind is aware of the environmental concerns, but there still are a lot, and there are a lot of things we don't know about the project as well.
And the Martha's Vineyard Commission has a meeting coming up on this?
They do. The meeting is going to be next Thursday. It's a public hearing, so that means that the public can join if they have concerns or they can voice support for the project. It is a large renewable energy project, so it's exciting and we're looking forward to it.
Noah Asimov from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us for that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times, your reporter Marianne Bragg covered a meeting on this that was held in Hyannis. This one was hosted by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so basically it kind of gave a public hearing to allow people to kind of go over and listen to the draft environmental report, which kind of looks over the construction and the operations plan and some of the stuff that Noah was talking about. And there were similar questions. There was stuff about the right whales, hoping there was kind of seal that issue up, as well as, I mean, there the Cape Cod Fishermen's Alliance had wanted to know more. I think there was a commercial diver wanted to know how this project could affect his profession. I mean, and you're talking, it's a big area, 160,000 acres off the vineyard there. So yeah, a lot of people just wanted kind of, I think the one, it was, there's anglers for offshore wind power. They're a recreational fisherman. They wanted guarantees that public access will be allowed near the turbines. You think about the fishing mm-hmm. industry. It's obviously some big concerns for them because this is their livelihood out there.
A lot of questions here still outstanding people are pointing to, but it looks as though there's also a lot of momentum for this going on. And even people, as reported here by Marianne Bragg, people with the questions are also saying that, you know, they understand that wind power is a part of the picture here, that they're expecting to help the state going forward environmentally in a bigger way.
Yeah, the state has really set a priority on wind energy, and I think they've set a goal. I forget it off the top of my head here, but I think this is a big chunk towards that goal. And just kind of cutting down climate change, obviously anything climate change or coastal issues for us is we're all front line here. So Yeah, I mean, and like Noah was saying with the cables, some of the folks at Colville, where it's going to come in at Colville Beach over in Barnstable, I think some people are starting to be swayed over and seeing kind of the improvements. Obviously, some people still have some big questions, and like you said, about the seafloor and kind of interruption to the habitat.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, teachers in the Monomoy School District have a new contract. We've talked about this on the Roundup before, as they've been working without a new contract for quite a while, and it's had an impact on a popular program at the high school. Tell us, what's going on?
Sure. Teachers in the Monomoy District have been working without a contract since July, so for this whole school year. One of the impacts of that, among other things, was the ceasing of the program at Monomoy High School called the Jossam Hour, which is a time that students get in the middle of the day, right around the lunch period, where they can get extra help from teachers or do extracurricular activities. And it was instituted about a year and a half ago and was thought to be very successful, but it wasn't in the previous teacher's contract. So when the contract expired and the negotiations were sort of going nowhere, teachers decided that, you know, we're going to stick to the contract that doesn't include the Jossam Hour, so we're going to cancel that. So they basically haven't had that popular period for most of the school year. But that will be back under the new contract, which both the teachers and the school committee ratified this past Tuesday. There were some pretty contentious negotiations over the past several months. Teachers would show up at the school committee meetings, in very big numbers, carrying signs, urging the school committee to settle the contract. Some of the contentious issues involved, of course, compensation, as well as the timing of the school day. And under the new contract that was ratified, teachers will be getting a 2% annual cost of living increase for each of the 3 years of the contract. And that's, of course, retroactive to this existing school year. It also sets up strict guidelines on the daily work hours that teachers are required to put in. And there are also revisions to how they do the grading systems, which will allow teachers more time to post grades. There's also some expanded health care options for teachers, which school committee members say could actually save the district a little bit of money if teachers opt for some of these, higher deductible type of plans. Now, both sides say that although getting to this point was pretty difficult and challenging, they're satisfied with the new agreement. They say it's the best one that they could come up with for both teachers and students in the district. And it includes with the new compensation that was really built into the budget. And as we've talked about in the past, the Monomoy budget has been pretty problematic this year with its $400 million budget, up about 3%, and significantly shifting the responsibility from that budget more towards the Harwich side of things, which has caused a little bit of contention in that community. So the budget haven't been finalized yet. There was a budget hearing also on Tuesday, but the school committee did not vote to approve it. And the Chatham selectmen did vote to approve the school budget. Of course, their side of the funding picture is nice because their responsibility is going down by over $155,000. Harwich has not taken action on any sort of endorsement of that budget. But with the settling of the contract, they can do that because that money is now solidified in the budget.
Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Bowling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, the island's new hospital, which has been a long time coming, will see its first new patients next week.
It will. On Wednesday, the hospital is scheduled to open Wednesday morning at its current campus between Prospect Street and Vesper Lane. It has been a long time coming. It's been about a year and a half or so in construction and many more years before that in planning and fundraising. It's a $90 million project to build the hospital, and they raised about another $20 million for housing on the site as well. It's about 106,000 square feet in size compared to 65,000 square feet for the current hospital that opened in 1957, and as much work as they've done over the years to keep it up to standards, it just simply doesn't meet 21st century building standards or care models, and hospital officials determined that they needed to build a new one, and it was funded completely with private donations from island residents, island visitors, businesses. No taxpayer money went into this new state-of-the-art hospital, much bigger and much more sort of contemporary than the former hospital. 28 exam rooms compared to 21 in the current hospital, two operating rooms instead of one in the current hospital, more staff amenities, including locker rooms and private break rooms. The emergency department, which gets use year-round, obviously, but a lot of use in the summertime when the population booms, is almost 7,400 square feet compared to about 4,400 square feet of the current hospital. And there are 12 exam rooms there compared to 7 currently. So a bigger, more state-of-the-art hospital going to be opening on Wednesday. There's more services for outpatient. There's more inpatient services. And all the doctors, the primary care physicians, are going to be located in a central portion of the hospital, except for Dr. Tim Leprey, who's remaining on the campus, but in a separate office. Right now, the doctors are scattered among a number of different buildings. So going to make it easier and more efficient for islanders and visitors alike to use the new hospital once it opens on Wednesday.
Josh, town election is not far over the horizon in April. That means the deadline is nearing to get on the ballot.
It is Tuesday. End of the day Tuesday is the deadline to have your name included on the ballot for those races up for election. Right now, there are 7 candidates who have pulled papers for Select Board, the most popular seat right now. There are also contested races shaping up for Planning Board, the Land Bank Commission, and the Nantucket Water Commission. On the flip side of the coin, the Harbor and Shellfish Advisory Board, as of this week, had more seats up for election with 3 than candidates who had taken out papers with 2. But none of those incumbents are running either for that board, and their incumbents only running for seats on the Historic District Commission and School Committee at this point, but there is still a little time left. One incumbent Select Board member, actually Jim Kelly, did pull his papers, but said this week that he's not going to run again. The other incumbent, Matt Fee, said that he is. He hasn't returned his papers yet, but he said he will run. He is going to be faced by former Select Board member Tobias Glidden, retired college professor and historian Fran Kartunen, the former director of the Islands African Meeting House, Charity Grace Mofson, developer and interior designer Jill Veith, and they've all taken out their papers, and Glidden, Cartoon, and Veith have returned theirs as well. So we'll wait to see what happens on Tuesday, and there could be a few more candidates by that point, or a couple may also not return their papers. So we'll have all that in Thursday's paper, or we can find out if the ballot's been set leading up to the April annual town election.
Josh Bowling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for that.
Thank you.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Ethan, in Falmouth, contention continues over the efforts to bring to town a needle exchange, which would also offer other support services, including counseling. The Town Board of Health met this week to talk about a call for them to rescind its letter of support for this. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod got a letter of support from the Board of Health down in Falmouth, and there's been calls, like you said, to rescind that. There's been a lot of anger over the location, the original location that was planned. It was over by St. Anthony's Church over on East Falmouth Highway. They are no longer pursuing that location, but there were still people saying you should really pull your support. That letter of support, I think, is needed because if you're looking for state funding, mm-hmm. you need to get that letter of support. But the board said, no, we're gonna keep backing this idea.
And talk to the AIDS group of Cape Cod brought a lot of information about why it's so important to have this program running here.
Yeah, they kind of brought some Falmouth stats, which were a little eye-popping. There was the one, Falmouth had 101 drug-related emergency calls in 2018, which is only 2 less than Brockton.
Which has a much larger population.
If you've ever been to Brockton, it's a lot bigger than Falmouth is. And then they also said AIDS and hepatitis C are increasingly spreading through needle use. I mean, if you don't know what the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod does, they do they do HIV and sexually transmitted disease screenings. They also do overdose reversal medication. They hand those out, as well as needles, which is kind of the real controversial mm-hmm. issue. This meeting got heated like other ones that have. Phil Alfonso, who is a local yokel, got pulled out of the meeting with a escorted by a couple officers, police officers. So obviously this is still a fiery topic in town, and it's going to keep going. There's another forum later this month, February 26th, at the Falmouth Jewish Congregational down in East Falmouth.
We'll call Phil a local, a Falmouth local, yes. We're going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. Do I get to be called a local yokel? I want to be a local yokel.
Casey, there's a big reconstruction project going on at Herring Cove Beach, and it looks like the timetable for completion is being pushed back until after the summer, or at least for the north lot. Tell us what's happening.
Yes, the north lot is the one that's very, very popular because you can kind of drive right up to the asphalt goes right up to the beach and you can watch the waves from your car. It was designed in the 1950s and the design hasn't really lasted the test of time. It's been that parking lot has just been hammered, especially since 2011, and most of it, of the old parking lot, was gone by the time this reconstruction project began. And the original plan was to move the parking lot back 200 feet and raise the elevation 15 feet and replant it all, which is really good because right now it looks like a lunar landscape. It's just all, you can't even recognize this 50-year-old beach right now. It's very cool what's going on. But anyway, so over in the past, after they announced their original plan to move it 200 feet back, fast-paced erosion just kept on hammering, and they decided to move it, the lot 400 feet back instead. So that was already hampering, that last-minute change of plans was kind of already hampering the ability to open by July 1st, which was the Cape Cod National Seashore, which owns Herring Cove. That was their original plan. Anyway, July 1st isn't going to work because of that, and then the 35-day government shutdown stopped all construction for a month, mm-hmm. and that just pretty much was the nail in the coffin for the beach to reopen, or that parking lot to reopen in this summer. The plan also includes moving the Province Lands Road, and that part will open, that's good. That would be pretty disruptive to not have the road open. So they believe they'll have the road open by the summer. And it's a very dynamic area out there. It's just hard to believe that parking lot existed for so long. Herring Cove, people still can go to Herring Cove, though. There's a 400 parking space south lot, which is still fine and hasn't been disturbed. That's separated by dunes, and you have to do some walking to get to the beach. But Herring Cove still will be open.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us with that update.
Thank you.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, in Barnstable, a community group is continuing its fight against a proposed cell antenna to go in a church steeple.
Yeah, so this has been another kind of ongoing issue down in Centerville at the, I think it's the South Congregational Church. There's more than 100 people at a Barnstable Planning Board meeting, which again is an astronomical number if you've ever been to a planning board meeting or any kind of municipal government meeting. And they were hearing a proposed regulatory agreement between the town and T-Mobile, who is proposing to put these cell antennas in the church steeple. A lot of the people are citing they have worries about adverse health effects in the community. The problem is that T-Mobile and the planning board don't have a lot of jurisdiction mm-hmm. to shoot something like this down. Your scope is very narrow on what a town can deny for these kind of things. And the town attorney basically said, you don't have a lot of ways to say no to this.
T-Mobile's been presenting a report, which is indicating that there's a service gap in this area, which kind of is going to give them permission, essentially, to go in and put a cell antenna there to close the service gap. Some of these folks in the community are questioning the validity of this report.
Yeah, and I think what did they say? They was called a drive test, I think, and yeah, they were questioning that. They're still not totally convinced that T-Mobile's inadequate service in that area is actually a thing. So yeah, this is going to continue to keep going forward. They've talked about possibly, I mean, if Barnstable says no to this, I mean, you're likely looking at a lawsuit from T-Mobile, which probably has a lot deeper pockets than the town. And I think the town attorney said it would be a steep uphill climb to defend that lawsuit successfully. But one of the members said it might be time to fight the fight. So we'll see how that turns out. That could be an interesting one.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Ethan Genter. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times, Ethan Genter. And on the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Ethan.
George, how are you?
George, the last part of the independent review of the Steamship Authority has been released. It's the portion that deals with communications. The Steamship Authority board took it up on Saturday along with some other business, including making a hire to help implement recommendations from the overall review. None of this was without some controversy. Can you explain for us what's happened here?
That's right. Well, first of all, where they held the meeting was somewhat of a controversy here on the island. Because the meeting was held in Hyannis. The only possible place that could have been worse for islanders to get to would have been Nantucket. The Steamship Authority did have a shuttle bus from Woods Hole to Hyannis for Vineyarders, but that would have required getting up at 6 o'clock, getting on a ferry at 7, and, you know, who wants to do that on a Saturday morning on short notice? So, but a couple of people did actually make it.
Getting on the ferry at 7 to get to Woods Hole to get on a bus to go to Hyannis, another 40 to 50 minutes away, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're pretty much burning your day at that point. So that didn't start off very well. And then at the actual meeting, the SSA is starting to make some decisions on hiring HMS Consulting to help them facilitate some of the recommendations that HMS Consulting has made in their initial top-to-bottom review and now in this communications review that was done. And that's not sitting well either, because the SSA promised to come over to the Vineyard to talk about the reports, and they have yet to schedule a meeting over here. You know, and that's there have been a couple of island officials who've been disappointed about that as well. Now, the bones of this actual report, the communications report, there's really nothing all that surprising in it. The SSA, being too reactive in its communications, slow to get information out, and when they did get information out, probably giving out more than they needed to give out at that time. What people really wanted to know is, when's the boat running? If it's not running, when's it going to be back? And they were giving details that had to do with what went wrong. And so that was one of the things that was pointed out, but in this communications report. Interestingly, some changes have been made by the SSA already in communications. This was the last report to come out, but they have already hired a communications director, Sean Driscoll, used to work for the Cape Cod Times, and he has done some positive things. He's given them a presence on Facebook. He's given them a presence on Twitter. Things are getting out quicker when storms, for example, are in the forecast. You'll see Sean tweeting about it. posting it on their Facebook site. And so people are being alerted sooner to issues. When there are actual cancellations, that's still somewhat of a struggle for people. The alerts come out, you know, very close to the time when a boat is going to be departing. And so that's not very helpful because, you know, people are already headed to get in line. So that's something that could be certainly cleaned up in the days, weeks, and months ahead.
There was another piece of Steamship Authority news this week. I want to bring in Ethan here to talk about this. Falmouth, the town of Falmouth, has a new appointee to the Steamship Authority Governing Board.
Yeah, so this was kind of an interesting story. So each port community in the Steamship Authority, so New Bedford, the Two Islands, Barnstable, and Falmouth, they all each get a member on the governing board of the Steamship Authority. So Falmouth had one. Her name is Elizabeth Gladfelter. She worked down here at Hui. Her term had run up, but according to the enabling legislation, if you don't appoint somebody or reappoint the person in the seat can continue to serve.
Mm-hmm.
Betsy didn't want to keep serving in the seat if she wasn't reappointed. She was worried that it was kind of, if there was a disagreement between her and the board, that she could they would just hold an appointment hearing and put somebody else in, basically. So she resigned. She ended up applying again. They picked somebody else. They went with Catherine Wilson. She's a Falmouth attorney, Woods Hole resident, who had definitely some Falmouth-centric things to tell the board, that she was talking about the trash and the trucks that
trash hauling and,
yep,
and trying to.
I currently both go through Falmouth. There's been calls to have them go through New Bedford. And I bet George would like to talk about one of the other candidates, if you want to go ahead, George.
Yeah, so one of the candidates was James Morse, who is a police officer in Oak Bluffs up until November, when an internal affairs report uncovered that he had used the FBI system inappropriately. He had done some background checks on people who weren't under investigation, and so he was terminated. Interestingly, on his resume for the town, he put that he's a retired Oak Bluffs police officer. They did allow him to keep his pension, so technically he is retired, but he was retired for cause, let's say.
And George, before we let you go, I want to ask you about one other story you've got. It's an article about an island tattoo parlor offering a free, very specific tattoo.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. They posted this on their Facebook site, Cottage City Tattoo, almost immediately after the State of the Union address. You know, people have called it the clapback heard round the world. That's, of course, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. Became a meme rather quickly on social media, her clapping at the president. And so Cottage City took advantage of that and is offering a free Nancy Pelosi tattoo to any takers. So our reporter Brian Dowd went out and talked to them about that and talked to them about their whole business. It's an interesting story. They have they're quite the artists. You can see it's a likeness, and Brian did, he didn't get the tattoo, but he did play along for a little while.
He had them put the stencil on him. So
that's right.
He got pretty close.
Absolutely. You do what you have to do when you're in journalism to really immerse yourself in the story.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. A downtown Hyannis hotel has been sold. It seems to be an indicator of the economic strength of this area.
Yeah, so the east end of Hyannis is kind of the west end. There's been a lot of stuff going on down there. So this is kind of some of the moves. Another beacon of one of the moves over in the east end is the Heritage House. It was recently bought, Aria Hospitality, for $7.85 million. I don't know if you've ever stayed at the Heritage House, but it's not a bad spot. I stayed there once when I got evicted from an apartment. There is, so the guy's going to be taking over. I think supposed to be doing some decent renovations. They're going to be doing refreshing the exterior, updating some of the rooms. It is a very old school kind of hotel.
It's a 50-year-old building, is what they say. Yes,
yes, yeah. So they're definitely going to bring it to modern hospitality standards. One of the things they are doing is they're going to be closing the bar and grill Chauncey's over there. That's going to be basically the owner said they want to support local restaurants. So they're going to be shutting that down. And this seems to be the Hyannis Main Street Business Improvement District seems to be in favor of this move. They seem excited to work. And I think they called it a linchpin of kind of that Main Street property.
And there are a couple of other developments going up there along that area as well in the neighborhood.
Yeah, there was the Cape Built development over on 255 Main. They're doing stuff, I think it's right next door to the Heritage House, and there's Captain's Row, which is doing some market-rate apartments down along Pleasant and South Street. So yeah, that kind of east side is starting to see some movement.
Let me ask you about a story on the roundup. We've been following this for a little bit. The Waldorf School of Cape Cod and the town of Barnstable is seeking to end the school's lease in a town-owned building. Now the Waldorf School is going to court in the matter. Explain what's happening here.
So, yeah, so the Barnstable Schools Committee, which kind of controls this, they're planning to terminate the lease on June 30th for the Waldorf School over in Kituit. The Waldorf School is saying the town needs to give them 540 days notice, which is a lot more than what they have right now. So yeah, they brought that filed it last week in Barnstable Superior Court, and basically they're saying this would give us time to find a new site, which right now they're talking just the end of the school year. You're barely going to make it. So.
Saying that the lease called for them to have, the understanding in the lease was for them to have more time before the termination of their contract.
Yeah, so there's a 20-year lease with every 5 years it's kind of reassessed. What the superintendent of the school district is saying is that 540-day clause, that notice the Waldorf school is saying they needed, she's saying, the superintendent is saying that only comes into play if the lease were terminated before the end of that five-year cycle. So, yeah, it's kind of depends on how you read this. Obviously, the Waldorf School is not doing the greatest financially. They've been in back pay. I mean, they owe the school district a lot of money. I mean, as deep as 75 grand in past. I think they're at 20-something now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's... basically is how you interpret a lease, which is always interesting legally.
And they're also saying that Barnstable has been in talks with another group about use of this building, which may be behind the whole, what they feel is a sort of very quick and sudden shift to move them out of there.
Yeah, the complaint from the Waldorf School said that Barnstable was talking to the Cape Cod Collaborative, whose programs include they have special education classes. And they're talking about expanding their plans, the collaboratives, to also help drive this decision to terminate the Waldorf School's lease.
And the Waldorf School of Cape Cod pointing out that whatever happens here, they're not closing. They plan to go through all of this and come out with a new location.
Yeah.
Cindy McCormick has an article in the Times this week about the Cape's community health centers continuing to expand. This comes as a new office for one of them is added in Centerville.
Yeah. So the Cape Cod, it's the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. They recently opened their fourth location right there on, I think it's right there on Falmouth Road. They're going to be open Monday to Thursday, 8 to 6. And this is kind of generally a thumbs up from some people. I mean, they really want to see more availability with these kind of things. They're seeing increased demand in these underserved areas because Centerville is obviously in between kind of the Hyannis, Cape Cod Hospital, and Falmouth Hospital down here.
And Cindy goes on to detail some of the impacts of community health centers across the region. And the numbers of patients that are served here it's substantial. Just 17,000 patients alone in that particular community health center of Cape Cod. Also Duffy Health Center, Outer Cape Health Services. and sees, I think, another 17,000 patients annually. So a lot of patients here being served by community health services across the region.
Yeah, and I mean, one guy said, I mean, this one is really helpful. I can go. He's a landscaper. If I got a slow day in the business where if you have to go down to somewhere else, you have to book kind of really portions of your day to go do this. So yeah, this is a welcome thing from a lot of people.
And these other health centers, Duffy Health and Outer Cape Health, also going through expansions now or in the near future to increase their services, which shows the sign that it's a healthy model anyway for serving the community.
Nice pun there.
Bald eagles making a comeback in Massachusetts. There may even be nesting pairs here on the Cape, but nobody's located one yet.
No one's seen the nests. People have seen the eagles, I believe, for the first time in 114 years. There's been sightings of pairs down in Mashpee, over by Wakeby Lake, Long Pond in Harwich, and Lake Wequaka in Centerville. But yeah, that's still that hard evidence of an actual nest is still lacking. So that's the, but it's a pretty exciting. I think the last time a bald eagle was a breeding pair was sighted out here was when Teddy Roosevelt was our president.
Now these birds can travel tremendous distances, so they're being seen all across the Cape region. And the question is whether they're coming from outside of the region, flying over, or the presumption that there is a nest here somewhere.
Yeah, we want to know if they're Washershores or not.
And the nests here are—you're not just talking about a little nest in a bough of a tree here. These are big undertakings.
Yeah, these nests are 4 to 5 feet in diameter and about 2 to 4 feet deep. So yeah, you'd notice one. Yeah, they're not small little things.
And they're typically at the top of trees down by water. Is that right?
Yep. And I think kind of one of the things that naturalists are saying is it's only a matter of time till one is found because of some of the reforestation efforts around. So yeah, we'll see. If you spot one, let us know.
Ethan, you have a cute story you covered this week about some young students on a mission to save souls. Shoe souls, that is.
Yeah. No, the Laurel School out in Brewster isn't getting into soul saving just yet, but they're collecting shoes. They're hoping to get 2,500 pairs by the end of March, and what they're doing is they're collecting these shoes, and there's this organization called Funds to Orgs. They come, pick them up, and then they send them to developing countries, people, micro-entrepreneurs, they call them, these small family businesses, and those businesses, they take the shoes and sell them to try and make more money. So the Lower School is trying to get some more shoes, so if you got gently worn or new shoes, they don't want your old beaters, bring them on over to the Laurel School.
And the Laurel School sees this as part of their kind of the mission of their educational mission here.
Yeah, so one of the core things at the Laurel School is service. And so they do fundraisers a lot. They've done it for the Lower Outreach Council, Lower Cape Outreach Council, World Wildlife Fund. So yeah, one of the things they try and instill in the kids is service.
I want to ask you about a couple of stories in today's paper that you wrote. Provincetown is going to be seeing something new, a couple of brew pubs planning to open there.
Yeah, so actually a month or two ago, I wrote a story how Provincetown could become the marijuana capital of the Cape, and now it could be the brewery capital. They're going from zero possibly to two. There's one at the 1620 Brew House, which is a restaurant, and there's the attached Art House Theater. There was some hubbub this summer about kind of the plan was to put in this brewery in the restaurant, but it would take over the theater.
In place of the theater, displacing the theater, yeah.
Yep, so that raised a lot of concerns in the community. So so Ben DeRider, the owner, has now changed a heart. He said, we're going to make a performing arts center, which has got a lot of people pretty excited out there in Provincetown for this, and then we're still going to have the brewery as well. So they put in their first plans, were unveiled just recently.
And another brew pub possibly down the street?
Yeah, down over on the plans to have another one on Bradford. It's the Provincetown Brewing Company. Their mission is to do a lot of fundraising. Sales from every beer is going to go towards local and organizations.
Community give backs.
Yep, yeah, exactly.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times. Ethan, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.